Hello, it's Monday the 1st of December 2008. I'm Mike Duran. On today's podcast, accusation and recrimination in Mumbai. What next for India?
Now India claims it's a victim of terrorism because elements in Pakistan have been allowed to arm and train young men to act as urban commando gangs and to perpetuate mass terror on the streets of Mumbai.
The Clinton comeback.
I think it was a surprise to most people when her name was floated for such a senior foreign policy position.
As the recession bites, charities face a £2.3 billion black hole.
The government needs to help us to support those people.
No such worries for Russia's super rich.
These are the most expensive helicopters in the world.
How much are they, Maria, if you don't mind my asking? Could you tell us?
This baby that you see cost approximately 3 million euro. But
okay.
If we are speaking about 139, it can be more than 12 million.
And the benefits of war as medicine adapts to the needs of theatre. First, a news update and a look at the papers with Sandy Waugh.
Senior intelligence officials in Pakistan have warned that military operations against Islamist militants will end if India deploys troops on their eastern frontier. This comes as members of the Indian government continue to suggest that last week's attacks in Mumbai originated in Pakistan. The Indian government's raised security to war level, but is struggling to contain public anger over the attacks, which many people feel could have been averted. There's more on this to come in Guardian Daily from our correspondent in Mumbai. The Royal Bank of Scotland's announced that as of today, it'll give its customers more leeway in making mortgage repayments. RBS, which also owns NatWest, will wait until homeowners are at least 6 months in arrears before beginning repossession proceedings. Repossessions have soared in recent months and millions of new homeowners face negative equity as house prices continue to fall. Meanwhile, on the high street, shoppers will pay reduced levels of VAT from today. The reduction was announced in last week's pre-budget report. The Speaker of the House of Commons is coming under mounting pressure from MPs today to explain why police were allowed to raid the parliamentary offices of Conservative frontbencher Damien Green. The Leader of the Commons, Harriet Harman, has told Mr Martin that an urgent review of procedures is required. The Home Secretary, Jackie Smith, meanwhile, says she was not given warning of the raid. She said yesterday the police had to be allowed to follow the evidence where they need to. Damien Green was arrested but not charged by police investigating the leak of Home Office documents. Anti-government protesters in Thailand have entered their seventh day of blockade of Bangkok's international airport. The People's Alliance for Democracy, which has occupied two airports in its campaign to topple the Thai Prime Minister, let some planes leave the main airport last night, but there was little sign of other compromise. Police have ordered thousands of protesters to end the blockade and warned that offenders could be jailed. Thousands of foreign tourists remain stranded in Bangkok. And the space shuttle Endeavour has touched down safely in California following a flight to the International Space Station. The mission involved carrying out repairs to a machine that recycles water from urine. There was also a delivery of additional sleeping quarters with a view to expanding the crew next year. Now for a look at today's papers, and The Sun continues its campaign against social workers it believes were negligent in protecting a baby who died in Haringey, North London. It pictures three of the workers on its front page above the headline, Go Now. The Telegraph leads with a threat from some MPs to disrupt the state opening of Parliament in protest at the arrest of Shadow Home Secretary Damien Green. The Mail asks whether Home Secretary Jackie Smith knew about the raid and claims that Cabinet ministers are appalled at how the case has been handled. In The Times, columnist William Rees-Mogg calls the arrest a historic attack on liberty and democracy. The Express identifies what it calls a new stealth tax on motorists. The 2p rise in fuel duty will not be cancelled out by today's cut in VAT, it claims. An editorial in the Financial Times says following the siege in Mumbai, there must not be an escalation towards a confrontation with Pakistan. That's a fear identified in bold on the front pages of both The Independent and The Guardian. On the back pages, Arsenal's 2-1 win against Chelsea dominates, as does Cristiano Ronaldo, who was sent off during Manchester United's 1-0 defeat of Manchester City yesterday. More news and sports throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
We start today with the fallout from the three-day rampage that killed nearly 200 people in Mumbai. Over the weekend, while bodies were still being removed from the erstwhile besieged hotels, anti-government protesters took to the streets demanding to know how this was allowed to happen. Latest figures show that 174 people died, another 239 were injured. The attacks have also threatened to unravel India's improving ties with its nuclear rival Pakistan. The Guardian's South Asia correspondent Randeep Ramesh is in Mumbai to discuss this and other consequences.
On one side of the border you have India, which is raising its intelligence briefings to the, quote, level of war. On the other side of the border you have Pakistan sending troops from the Afghanistan border to the Indian border and therefore saying to the international community, we will weaken in the war against terror that you're bothered about in Afghanistan to put down this threat from India, which we believe we have nothing to do with. So you have these two sides who have gone back to basically talking to each other but not understanding each other. Now, India claims it's a victim of terrorism because elements in Pakistan have been allowed to arm and train young men to act as urban commando gangs and to perpetuate mass terror on the streets of Mumbai. Pakistan's response is, show us the proof. And that's where we are at the moment.
Have the intelligence agencies actually been able to piece together then how the operation was planned? It seems like they've got their argument fairly clear, you know, how this was planned and executed so effectively.
Well, that's certainly what the Indians, that's what's been coming out of the Indian police and security services, is they're briefing very hard that what they have is a man in custody who is the baby-faced urban guerrilla that we saw shooting people dead in Victoria Terminus in Mumbai on Wednesday night. He's been in custody and he's been singing. He's been saying exactly what happened, how he was trained, who trained him, where he was taken, how he was brought to Mumbai. Now, we only have media reports to substantiate that. There's very little apart from that. Now we hear new information coming out that a satellite phone was picked up in a boat. Now, the satellite phone in this context is fairly important because those calls can be listened into both by the Americans, National Security Agency, GCHQ in Britain, and of course Indian intelligence. Therefore, the Indians are trying to suggest, the Indian intelligence agencies are saying, we just don't have this guy. We also have corroborative evidence in the form of phone transcripts, which all international agencies will probably have access to. So they're trying to build up their case. For Pakistan, I think, it's a different problem. It's a problem of saying, we are victims of terrorism. We are a nation which has suffered from terrible acts of terror, and we are attempting to do something about it. Now, therein lies the international community's problem, which is you have to be sensitive to the scale of terror in Mumbai because it's a new phase in urban commando terrorist activity. We haven't seen gunmen being able to paralyze 10 people, 20 people, paralyze one of the great commercial centers of Asia. That sends a big warning out to the rest of the world. And of course, you've seen foreigners die. The last time foreigners died was in the mid-90s in Kashmir in India. So that's another big signal to the rest of the world that an important growing economy that, you know, the world all hopes will ascend to the great heights of superpowerdom could actually be lost in a cloud of or a hail of gunfire and the shattering of shrapnel.
And the public reaction, we've seen anti-government protests over the weekend. I saw some of the footage. They had placards saying 62 hours of trauma, how much more? They're asking why our system's not in place to prevent this kind of tragedy. Put simply, what went wrong?
It's a good question to ask. I think the Prime Minister himself, after the Delhi bombings earlier this year, said there were gaps in the intelligence services. The knowledge, the ability to cope with pan-Indian terrorism is something that the Indian state is only just getting to grips with. Before, it was very effective in putting down regional terror centers. It was very good at dealing with Kashmiri militants. I mean, of course, it's basically state terrorism to fight terrorism, if that's the language you'd like to use. But they did it in Punjab. They do it in the Northeast, where you basically abrogate people's human rights. And, you know, you fight them on the streets using their methods. But that doesn't work across a country where you can see attacks this year in Rajasthan, in Jaipur, you saw attacks in UP, you saw attacks in Delhi. It's a federal system. Now, how do those state forces coordinate with each other? Where is the single overarching body that allows you to deal with the pan-Indian experience of terrorism? That's the new form of terrorism that India has seen. And coupled with that is the kind of different commando tactics that people have been given. You know, that we haven't seen that before. This is just not 10 bombs left on a train. This is 10 guys walking around, shooting and killing on sight. So there are two problems for India. It is simply not equipped to deal constitutionally with the problem of the new form of terrorism. And that's what many states are probably looking and thinking, are we similarly equipped? And therein probably lies the intelligence community sort of message, which is we probably need to reform ourselves pretty quickly. Otherwise, we could seriously lose much more than just economic activity in India.
Randeep Ramesh. Elsewhere on The Guardian's website today, the binge-drinking clampdown in Wednesday's Queen's Speech. That's at guardian.co.uk/UK. Which dragon is sniffing around Woolworths to buy up more than just a pound of pick and mix? Go to guardian.co.uk/business. Get the results of the BIFTAs, that's the British Independent Film Awards, at guardian.co.uk/culture, plus the latest from the Premiership at guardian.co.uk/sport. Next to America, where Barack Obama is naming his national security team, and among the names is a very familiar one. Hillary Rodham Clinton will be the president-elect's Secretary of State, the woman whose foreign policy experience Obama dismissed during his campaign. The rest of the team is expected to include a UN posting for his campaign foreign policy adviser, Susan Rice, and Eric Holder becomes Attorney General. The Arizona Governor, Janet Napolitano, takes her place at the Homeland Security Department. The Guardian's LA correspondent, Dan Glaister, has more.
I think it was a surprise to most people when her name was floated for such a senior foreign policy position, indeed the most senior foreign policy position. But presumably part of the leaking was intended to get us used to the idea. So 2 weeks later, it's sort of, you know, oh, well, yeah, obviously she's going to be Secretary of State. Yeah, I mean, things, you know, it was pretty vitriolic during the primary campaign. And the line from both teams was that, you know, well, these things obviously happen during the course of a campaign. But nevertheless, it was pretty testy stuff. You know, Obama said, you know, what experience exactly did she have, you know, after she'd sort of engaged in this sort of boosterish thing of talking up her experience in Bosnia and Northern Ireland and all these things. And he sort of confronted her very directly for him on that. And she in turn said, well, you know, a lot of people made speeches against the war in 2002, and who the heck were you, Sonny, sort of thing. So they've managed to get their way around that, which is sort of surprising. The other surprising thing, I think, to me anyway as well, is that personal relations between the two certainly weren't good at that time, and you know, it's been a long and rocky road since. But I think really it was only in the very late stages of the presidential campaign that things warmed.
Now, Obama attacked Clinton for voting for the Iraq war, and Clinton attacked Obama for saying he would meet unconditionally with leaders of nations such as Iran and Cuba. Do they come together at all on policy?
Yeah, okay. If you're a Democratic insider, then you say, well, you know, these are just little nuances of, you know, shades of opinion that, you know, will naturally emerge between two, you know, free-thinking.
What,
spirits.
Going to war or not going to war?
Well, that's what they're trying to tell us, yeah. I mean, yeah, you know, it was the cornerstone of Obama's early appeal, really, to certainly to a large portion of the Democratic Party, and indeed beyond that was his opposition to the war. And you know, you look back at the debates, both the primary debates and the presidential debates, and he really hammers on that and stresses all the time that he was the person, you know, the lone voice, blah, 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 blah. The thing about meeting foreign leaders without preconditions was something that he said in one of the primary debates with Clinton standing next to him, and she picked up on it during the debate, and it was widely seen as a gaffe, at least among the sort of commentariat, it was seen as a gaffe. What they say now is that, yes, there will be not his master's voice, but there will be a unified, you know, message coming through. And you sort of think that will probably be the case in the, you know, the Obama team and the incoming administration seems to be a pretty disciplined operation.
And to use your words, the commentariat amongst them, there is talk that the door to the job is opened because of a deal done between Barack Obama and Bill Clinton. Is everyone happy about that situation?
I think everybody's happy that there is greater transparency being brought to the workings of the Clinton Global Initiative and the Clinton Foundation and the Clinton Library. I mean, one of the things he's had to do, or Clinton not had to do, has agreed to do, is to release the names of the 208,000 donors to the foundation, which was a source of contention during the campaign and certainly angered a lot of liberals, for want of a better word, who think that the Clintons should perhaps have been living up to a higher standard of transparency. I think the key to the agreement really is John Podesta, who is one of the leading figures in the transition team for Obama and was a White House chief of staff under Bill Clinton. So I think if you want to know how it happened and why it happened and what the give and take has been, then I think he is the key guy in this.
Dan Glaister. Back home, and as the recession bites, we're becoming more parsimonious with our charity donations. Fundraisers will likely be depressed by a new PricewaterhouseCoopers survey of 362 charities, which estimates a shortfall in contributions of £2.3 billion next year. Stephen Bubb is director of the Association of Chief Executives of Voluntary Organisations. He says both the small donations and larger corporate sponsorships are drying up.
As the recession bites, people think harder about their giving patterns, although giving's holding up quite well so far. It depends on how deep and how long the recession is.
The PricewaterhouseCoopers report estimates a shortfall of £2.3 billion. That's an awfully big hole to fill, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And it's not just the fact that giving is going to decline. It's also the fact that charities face rising costs and rising demand. So there's a real problem. As the recession bites, you'll expect people to turn to charities. We have a bigger role to play in homelessness, for example. Unemployment rising is an extra demand on charities. So it's a time when we actually need more money rather than less.
And if this leads to increasingly desperate people, what do you see as the corollary to this?
It's the issue, really, that we're putting to government that, you know, as we see giving decline and the effects of recession on communities, families, ordinary people, we think the government need to step into the breach and provide money to support the sector, as well as doing things like reforming gift aid. Because we estimate that we lose about £700 million a year through the way gift aid operates and the fact that we can't claim back all of the money that actually that we probably should get. What we're saying is that the recession bites and there are more demands in society, you know, the government needs to help us to support those people. So I wouldn't see it as a handout, but actually a way in which the government can provide support to those most in need.
And the figure you're after is 500 million. Would that be a loan or a gift?
No, it's a gift. It would be sort of emergency support. And that comes on top of other measures like reforming gift aid, for example, to support us at a time of, you know, giving declining.
Is it likely that some of the charities will fail? Some of them, of course, have become corporate behemoths, haven't they? Maybe, yeah, like the banks, a slimming down, yeah, is a good thing.
Well, there will undoubtedly be charities that fail. I mean, that's going to be inevitable. But one of the things Akivo has been saying, you know, as the charities body, is that chief executives should be looking at the opportunities for mergers, for partnerships, for alliances. It's a good time, just as in the private sector facing recession, a good time to look at your structures, your business plans, and see if you can merge rather than go to the walls. And you know, slimming down, I'm not sure about slimming down, but undoubtedly this is the time to be ahead and to look at the chances for mergers, that's for sure.
Stephen Bubb. As charities struggle for donations here, there are no such money worries for Russia's super rich. In fact, as most of us can only afford the one glass of wine, or maybe two, Moscow's oligarchs have been holding their own millionaires' fair, where only the filthy rich are welcome. It's a sort of one-stop shop where the wealthy can buy a beachside villa and the helicopter to take them there. The Guardian's Luke Harding is in Moscow to see how far his Guardian wage will go.
Well, I'm in Moscow at the 4th Millionaires Fair, which is an annual orgy here in Russia for the country's very rich and even richer than that. The problem there these days is that Russia's rich are not so rich anymore. They've lost fantastic sums of money. The whole oligarch class here has been very badly hit by the global economic crisis and has lost many billions. Now, I guess I'm going to try and find out whether there is still money in Russia, whether people are still sort of spending lots of money. The scene here is rather surreal. There are a lot of people in black tie, a lot of rather attractive young women in black cocktail dresses. I'm standing next to a woman in a hoop who's sort of pouring champagne. To my right is a helicopter, and to my left is an Aston Martin. But I think what's quite interesting is that while there are a lot of very kind of expensive brands here, you can buy everything from a yacht to an exclusive Dutch sculpture or even a Russian banner. The number of people here, I think, I would put in the hundreds rather than in the thousands, which perhaps is a sign that while the kind of party in Russia is not over yet, it's a kind of 2 a.m. moment, I think, when things are starting to fade. Anyway, I'm just going to go and examine a yacht to my left. So I'm with Eugenie Kochman, who is the distributor of a very, very big yacht. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Tell us about, it's very beautiful. It's white. It's enormous. It's got a dinner service. What is it?
Well, it's English boat, one of the most famous brands, which is produced in United Kingdom. The history of the brand is 45 years. The shipyard is based in Plymouth. And it's one of the biggest shipyards in Europe, which produce boats from 12 meter to 37 meter.
And how big is this one? This one looks enormous.
This one 18 meters, so it's not really a huge one, but it's one of the most popular sizes inside Russia.
But tell me, relations between Britain and Russia at the moment are pretty dreadful. Do you really think rich Russians are going to be doing something as unpatriotic as buying British boats?
Well, the relationship maybe is not good between our political people, but between normal people and normal businessmen, the relationship is very good.
Okay, so I'm with Maria Krapchitova, who is with the United Helicopters Group, and she's going to tell me about this rather marvelous helicopter I can see in front of me. Maria, what is it?
This is the Augusta 119 Koala. You see one of the smallest model of Augusta Westland. You see that it is not so small. And as about these helicopters we present at Millionaire Fair, these are the most expensive helicopters in the world.
How much are they, Maria, if you don't mind my asking? Could you tell us?
This baby that you see cost approximately 3 million euro. But
okay.
If we are speaking about 139, it can be more than 12 million.
Okay, I'm with Gina Shetty, who is selling an island in or near Ecuador.
It is Ecuador.
You're not selling all of Ecuador, you're selling part of it.
Selling parts of Ecuador.
Okay, tell me about your island, Gina.
Okay, we've purchased Ecuador Island in the world, which is the master developer of Nakheel. We have branded the island by Pacha, which is the world-famous nightclub from Ibiza, which has locations all over the world. We have brought Pacha to the UAE. We've converted this entire island into Pacha Island. So there's a Pacha nightclub, which has a capacity of over 4,000 people. And we have service apartments, which are those ones over here.
And Gina, we're looking at a rather dinky little wooden model. I can see there's beach, there's sea, there's a kind of, it's a sort of beachfront villa, right?
It is. This is directly on the in the water, you could say. You come downstairs and you're in the ocean, okay? Then we have the service departments, we have the villas, we have the nightclub, and we have a 5-star hotel, which is Pacha Hotel, being run by the Wyndham Hotel Group.
Okay, and if I buy myself one of these beachside villas, how much money will I need?
You'll need about 18 million dirhams for this. Okay. It's about
$3 million.
$3 million. Okay, for a villa.
It's worth every penny.
It's worth every.
Finally, I get to quote an Edwin Collins lyric. It goes, war, what is it good for? In the song, the answer is absolutely nothing, but a new exhibition contradicts Mr. Collins' assertions. War and Medicine highlights how medicines had to adapt to cope with the volume and changing nature of theatre casualties, from plastic surgery to coping with Gulf War syndrome. The Guardian's Andy Duckworth went to meet contemporary artist David Cotterill at the Wellcome Collection in London's Euston Road.
We're inside a panoramic recreation of Hercules. The Hercules is reenacting an evacuation from Cambastian in the middle of the desert in the southern provinces of Afghanistan to Kandahar, where there is a larger runway, and it's the beginning of the chain of events that takes a soldier who's been injured back to Selly Oak in Birmingham for treatment. The most impressive thing for me was the way in which people could cope with the abstraction of injury, because if you read about a soldier getting injured, or if you see a film about a soldier getting injured, it's part of a bigger story, and there's great explanation in terms of building up the character, you know, kind of the what happened to them afterwards. If you read a press story about a soldier being injured, it offers background, their family history, what's happening to them now. If you're working in a field hospital in the middle of a desert with no idea really of any reference points, it's not on a map, and it'd be impossible for you to really be sure if you're in Iraq or Afghanistan at that point, you have no context. And so you deal with the injuries purely as the violent trauma on its own. And for me, there was a kind of a profound dissatisfaction with that. When I came back, I felt a desperate need not only to recognise my ignorance beforehand of the frequency of these kind of events, these things which aren't necessarily making it into the news every day, but also to try and understand how these dramatic episodes relate to some kind of broader rationale, if that's possible. And so I spent 9 months trying to make contacts and find the people that were dispersed all over the country when they came back, and managed to, in some cases, kind of piece together the broader narrative, filling in the gaps for soldiers that had been sedated, and with them trying to explain to me something of the events that took place before and something of their lives now. The first person to be brought in was a suspected Taliban mortar commander. And so I suppose the first, you know, kind of shock in a way was that a military field hospital with everyone in uniform would be treating civilians, Taliban, suspected Taliban, and even children. And it was I suppose for many of the doctors, that was one of the great points of pride, in that they felt that somehow they had managed to maintain the same ethical values that they would have in civilian healthcare. But obviously there are difficulties. I suppose that there is a strangeness in terms of any medical professional carrying a gun. And certainly as they get further forward, they look more like soldiers and less like surgeons. And there is a confusing overlap period. It's not a sudden change. In Cambastian, everybody had a rifle. And the people which were essentially charged with saving lives also have been trained to some, you know, good standard in terms of how to take a life. And particularly for the helicopter teams, the medical emergency response teams that go out there, there is they try to avoid it, but there is a real possibility of one individual being in a position where they would feel it was necessary to fire their weapon, as well as also try and repair the damage that such a weapon could cause. And I found that hard to understand, how people can cope with that kind of constant moral tension. But people had managed to reconcile it. It's just there were many different explanations for how you do that. And I think it's down to a kind of personal conscience issue.
David Cotterill ending that report by The Guardian's Andy Duckworth. And you can hear more from the exhibition in our Science Weekly podcast when we speak to Ken Arnold, the man in charge. That's at guardian.co.uk/Science Weekly. That's it for today's Guardian Daily. You can download tomorrow's from 7:30 with John Dennis. Producing today were Roxanne Escobalis and Phil Maynard. I'm Mike Duran. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from